This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Any trip to the supermarket will tell you that beef is expensive these days, part of a rising tide in food prices. But U.S. beef is apparently a really good deal in the eyes of Brazilian meatpackers, especially given that their currency is worth more than the dollar. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. He's in Dubai preparing for our broadcast from the Middle East next week. It is Wednesday, March 5th. Glad to have you with us. Today, House lawmakers voted to subpoena the co-owner of that meatpacking plant that made headlines a few weeks ago. It's part of the investigation into the largest beef recall in U.S. history, stemming from a video of sick cows being led to slaughter. Also today, there is word of further consolidation in the meatpacking business. The world's biggest beef producer, Brazil's JBS, announced plans to buy up Smithfield Beef Group and National Beef Packing. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Meatpackers slaughter cows and other livestock, process their meat, and distribute it to stores. The industry in the U.S. has always been dominated by American-owned firms. Then Brazil's JBS came to town. In under a year, it bought Swift & Company, Smithfield, and National, the third, fourth, and fifth largest meatpackers in the United States. It's now bigger than heavyweights Cargill and Tyson. Steve Kay edits Cattle Buyers Weekly.
It's the most significant reorganization, arguably, in the history of the meatpacking industry. My list of the top five beef packers is soon to be reduced to three.
JBS can afford these acquisitions, which total more than $2.5 billion, because of the strength of the Brazilian currency. The Brazilian real has appreciated by about 25% against the dollar in the past year. Tom Trabot heads the Institute for Brazilian Studies at Columbia University. He says JBS joins a growing list of Brazilian firms that have stormed the international stage.
What we're seeing in some of the Brazilian names, Petrobras, Vale, Gerdau, something that people were never used to seeing. They're used to seeing big Chinese companies, big Korean companies, big Japanese companies, but one hadn't seen very large Latin American firms.
The JBS acquisitions might spark antitrust concerns. The combined company could slaughter 42,000 cattle a day, nearly a third of the nation's total. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
We won't call this a silver lining, but here's one side effect of rocky economic times. The bankruptcy business is booming. Corporate bankruptcy filings by the end of last September had already exceeded totals for all of 2006. Marketplace's John Dimsdale finds lots of anecdotal evidence that there's much more to come.
Jack Williams, the scholar in residence at the American Bankruptcy Institute, doesn't have to see the statistics to know business bankruptcies will be big in the future.
Premier bankruptcy firms are ramping up, not only bankruptcy attorneys, but financial advisors, turnaround managers, distress valuation experts. So many people are moving so quickly to get the expertise so that they're in place as this thing starts to snowball.
Bankruptcy partner Zach Clement at Fulbright and Jaworski in Houston can confirm the anticipation, even though so far his firm hasn't seen a lot of new cases.
One need only be in this business to know the frequency with which headhunter calls come has gone up very substantially in the last year or so.
If you're a restructuring professional, well, you know, it isn't such a bad sign.
Tony Clark heads up the reorganization practice at the law firm of Skadden Arps. He says until the middle of last year, Easy Credit made it simple for companies to refinance their loan.
It's the worst credit market, certainly in my career in the last 30 years, and I suspect it's probably the worst credit market in modern history. That tells you that an even greater number of these companies are not going to be able to refinance and are going to have to turn to Chapter 11 to restructure their balance sheets.
Clark says any company having trouble securing credit to refinance debt should contact a bankruptcy expert to take early advantage of Chapter 11's protection from creditors. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All placebos are created equal, right? Well, apparently not. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that a drug's price has a significant effect on whether it works, even if it's just a sugar pill parading as a drug. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
Participants thought they were testing a new drug for pain relief. In fact, everybody got placebos. Only one difference. Some were told the pills cost $2.50, while others were told they only cost a dime. Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational, was the lead researcher.
What we found was that the expensive pill reduced pain to a much larger degree than the cheap pills.
This could be significant for the $59 billion generic drug industry. The study helps explain why patients generally prefer brand-name drugs and why consumers think they are more effective than generic drugs, even though they have the same active ingredients. Glenn Melnick is a health economics professor at USC.
People still prefer brand names over generics simply because they have higher prices, and so the assumption is that they're better and they're going to have a higher effect and a higher benefit to the consumer.
And that may not be a bad assumption. Lead researcher Dan Ariely says the power of perception shouldn't be underestimated.
When you stand in the supermarket or in the pharmacy and you're thinking about, you buy the cheap generic, the expensive brand name, you might actually sometimes make a right decision by getting the expensive one because you might actually get more healing power out of it.
Ariely suggests that the FDA reconsider the way it evaluates drugs. Instead of testing medicines blindly, he says the FDA should include factors like price, since such variables may play a part in how well some drugs work. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Wall Street managed some small gains despite another spike in oil prices. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, the world's largest investment bank, Goldman Sachs, announced plans to spend $100 million on business education for women. The program will target women in the Middle East and Africa. Here in the U.S., another giant of commerce, Walmart, is changing the way it manages its philanthropic efforts. Margaret McKenna is president of the Walmart Foundation. She says the change is mostly in where contributions will go.
Locally, we only used to give from the store. So in a very local area.
Mm-hmm.
We are now giving statewide as well. So what we're doing is instead of going around asking each store to contribute, we've taken a part of that money and put it at the state level. To tell you the truth, is something we have actually done in the past, but it's sort of been, you know, ad hoc. And this way we're making more of a formula. And I would say the other change is that we're trying on the national level to be, you know, more focused, more strategic in several areas, in education, in training, economic development, and then health and the environment.
What prompted you to focus on these specific areas?
Well, I think we look at who our customers are and who our associates are, and we try to serve those needs. So education, you know, is the answer to a lot of problems in our country. If you can have access to good education and access to good health care and a safe environment, I think a basic.
So does that mean that you will be increasing the amount of the contributions to these various charities, or will this be redistributed in a way?
Well, we've increased the amount, and we've increased the amount of giving to Walmart every year. So we will increase the giving at the state level is a whole new program and the national level.
Is your decision to support healthcare funding tied at all to the development of your in-store pharmacies?
I think it's development to our concern. It's in response to our concern about access to healthcare. Lee Scott, who's the president of Walmart, has been very involved nationally with SEIU Union and with others in proposing and advocating for access for everyone for health care. And that's where our access issue and program is centered, really in our advocacy for the insurance that all people will have access to quality health care.
You noted that your charitable giving is up and indeed rose by 8% last year to $296 million. The company's net profit rose 12% to almost $13 billion. So your charitable giving is about 0.02% of the net profits. Is that good enough?
I would always like corporations to do more, and I think our company will. What I will say is Walmart is in the top part of the list in terms of the percent of giving of corporations today. And I think you'll find that many of them have cut back, actually, rather than moved up that number. So, you know, I think we could all do better, and we hope we will. But I'm certainly proud of what Walmart does and the people it reaches.
Margaret McKenna is the president of the Walmart Foundation. Thanks for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
It's only been a couple of years since Ask.com unceremoniously dumped Jeeves the Butler from its branding. Well, now the search engine says it will cater to women's questions about recipes, entertainment, and health instead of trying to compete with Google. Rebranding certainly isn't new as a corporate growth strategy. Xerox is working to change its image. The company has a new symbol that's getting the once-over at a trade show in Boston this week. Jennifer Collins reports on today's hardworking logo.
The branding world is no place for a slacker. Take Xerox's new logo. It has to catch your eye when you're running off copies, when you're clicking around cyberspace, and when you're watching it fly by. That's a Ducati 1098R. Xerox sponsors a team of the racing superbikes. Soon, they will all bear a bright red spherical logo alongside the Xerox name. The emblem may be tough to read as it whizzes past at 150 miles an hour, but Xerox is hoping it will deliver a new message about the company.
The redesign of Xerox is about asking customers and consumers to take a mental pause.
That's Richard Wergen, the company's vice president of branding.
There has been a perception gap in the marketplace and an assumption that people know what Xerox is about.
And Xerox is still in the copier business, but it also sells software, consulting services, systems to manage data. It's got operations all over the world and even on the International Space Station. And that bad balance sheet it was carrying, that's changed too. Profits were up 79% last quarter. Wergen says the new logo is part of a multi-million dollar rebranding campaign.
It's the biggest change that we've made to the Xerox identity for 40 years, and the biggest change to our overall brand identity probably in our company history.
He says the new trademark, this red globe with a signature white X, is a symbol of the future, a symbol of connection, a symbol of innovation.
It looks like a baseball that got drunk.
That's Rob Frankel, a branding expert based in Los Angeles. He says companies have been spending billions to rework old logos so that they can multitask for the web, in video, on cell phones. For instance, AT&T sought a new emblem when it acquired Singular. UPS has faced heavy competition from FedEx and recently went brown with its new insignia. And KFC is trying to build customer backing by giving a facelift to the Colonel. But Frankel says it's not enough that people know you.
They need to know why they should care. That's what you tell your designer. Give me a visual representation that will start or try to communicate why our brand is the only solution.
Artist Drew Doherty has heard that before. He specializes in designing logos for outdoorsy companies like Surf Outfitters. He's been through several rebranding campaigns. Sometimes he goes through hundreds of sketches.
This is not my best work, by the way.
His work has to be distinctive, especially when a company looks for a new logo. The design has to create a link between the old and the new that doesn't alienate the customer.
You've got to make the right choices that are respected by the core customer.
and, of course, desired by the masses.
And once the image is out there, Doherty has just one more wish for these hardworking logos, that they rise above the surf.
You've got shots on the covers of magazines where a guy's hauling butt coming down that wave. And believe me, every sponsor is praying that they can see that logo.
Whether it's on a surfboard or on a Ducati motorcycle. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace. Coming up, doing business at the Israeli border.
They bought many things. It was excellent, excellent. At least something moved.
Did you make a lot of money?
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks traded up in a volatile session today. Investors were buffeted by a disappointing bailout plan from troubled bond insurer Ambac. The Dow inched up 0.33%, 41 points to close at 12,254. The Nasdaq rose 0.5%, 12 points to end at 2,272. And the S&P ticked up 0.1%, 2 points to finish at 1,328. Ambac dove 19%. The company said it'll raise $1.5 billion in a bond deal, but it won't get any cash from the banks. Delta Airlines soared 9% and Northwest lifted 8% today. News of a meeting between pilot union leaders at the two carriers revived merger talks. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. And by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. President Bush speaks to mark the fifth anniversary of the Homeland Security Department. The Senate Health, Labor, and Pensions Committee takes up the issue of unemployment. And cars from all over the world make their debut at the 78th International Motor Show in Geneva. About 1,000 brands from 30 countries will be presented. Some 700,000 comparison shoppers are expected through the doors. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal, who's on assignment in Dubai. Worries over inflation brought the stock market down today in Shanghai. The Chinese premier delivered what amounts to his version of the State of the Union address, and he vowed to get a grip on a surging economy that's been pushing the cost of living way up for the Chinese working class. The political elite that's supposed to be in control finds itself confronted with a dilemma. On one hand, inflationary pressures are threatening to sow social unrest. On the other, entrenched provincial leaders could stand in the way of any serious reform. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
Pork is not the other kind of meat in China. It's the top choice. But lately, there have been shortages. Prices are up, and some critics of the central government have made a new saying popular: eight ministries can't take care of one pig. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao told the National People's Congress he wants to streamline the bloated government bureaucracy into fewer but more powerful agencies. Even as he spoke, though, there were signs those plans might end up being watered down. Sijin Chung watches China for the business research firm Eurasia Group. She's seen this kind of struggle before.
Every time they have tried this in the past, they can reduce the number of ministries for a few years, but inevitably it would balloon back into, you know, even numbers higher than previously.
Chung says oftentimes Beijing can't stop local officials from carrying out their own policies until it really brings the axe down. And she says that just doesn't make for efficient policy making. China watcher William Gamble of Emerging Market Strategies says that entrenched system is all but impossible to change.
The old Chinese expression about the mountains are high and the emperors are far away is that they're sort of past masters at getting around these orders that come down from Beijing.
Gamble says today's speech may have been greeted with polite applause from those entrenched lawmakers, but don't count on any quick fixes.
Remember, the prime directive in China is not to grow the economy. The prime directive in China is to grow the economy so that the Communist Party can stay in power.
Gamble says any attempt at change won't come smoothly. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Back stateside, one of the questions that keeps coming up in this whole mortgage mess is, how do we not learn from past market manias? When it comes to lessons about the economy, commentator David Frum reminds us that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Economists have learned some lessons from past recessions. For instance, emergency tax and spending bills seldom do any good. Fiscal stimulus almost always arrives too late, after the recovery has already begun. Worse, the usual result is a net economic nothing. The government borrows to give to consumers, who in turn use the money to reduce borrowing. Demand remains constant. One economist famously compared fiscal stimulus to attempting to refill a swimming pool by dipping a bucket into the deep end and pouring the water into the shallow end. Here's another lesson. Oil prices are reaching extreme highs. That's happened before. After the first shock, consumers substituted and conserved. Americans used less oil in 1988 than they did in 1978. Then the price slumped and slumped again. Conservation went out of style, and policymakers sadly realized that they had missed an opportunity. Okay, the price is high again. This is the perfect moment to pass a standby energy tax, a tax that would kick in when the price of oil falls below, say, $60 a barrel. Consumers could feel secure that if they make the investment in a hybrid car or a smaller house with a shorter commute, they won't feel like fools in 4 or 5 years. But that's not what Congress is doing. Instead, Congress is planning a round of crowd-pleasing kicks at the oil companies that will do nothing to promote American energy security. A third lesson. Big banks are stuck with hundreds of billions of dollars in bad real estate loans. That's also happened before, in the 1980s savings and loan crisis. Back then, everybody had to learn that the best way to unravel bad credit was fast. Yet once again, we are hearing prominent politicians urging rate freezes and foreclosure moratoriums, postponing the inevitable at great cost. We like to think that we get smarter as we get older, and that society makes intellectual progress from year to year. Not on present evidence. It would be bad enough if we did not know better. It's worse. We have unlearned what we do know.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His new book is Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. What lessons have you learned from the economic downturn? Go to marketplace.org and click on Your Economy. Today, Israel and the Palestinians agreed to resume peace talks. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice pressured both sides to stop the bloodshed after an Israeli offensive into Gaza left 125 Palestinians dead. It was Israel's response to a daily barrage of rocket attacks. Cross-border violence would seem to make business transactions in the area unthinkable. But stores on both sides do find ways to survive, barely. Today, we hear from the Israeli side. Daniel Estrin reports from the town of Sderot.
A few weeks ago, chess champion Ilan Cohen called for shoppers, as he does from time to time. 10,000 Israelis arrived from all over the country. Simon Maman beamed as shoppers poured into his electronics and knickknacks shop.
They bought many things. It was excellent, excellent. At least something moved.
Did you make a lot of money?
Of course. This Friday, like a half month, what I do usually.
Sderot's retail therapy lasted one day. Now Maman sits in his shop with the lights off. Maman's staying put for now, but about a third of the residents have already left, and the rest hardly venture out of their homes. The main downtown road is so still, it almost sounds like a nature reserve. But on any given day, this is the town's typical wake-up call. It's the Army's color red alert. Danny Dahan owns a supermarket. He says it's become routine. The siren wakes you up, you grab your kids out of bed, and you rush to the designated safe area in your house. For business owners like him, it's a tough way to start the day.
You get to work already tired and stressed out. It's really hard to concentrate.
He can't play music at his supermarket because customers wouldn't be able to hear the Army's warning siren. He can't even announce sales over the loudspeaker because customers are so jumpy.
You know, like cornflakes 990. The ad makes people think it's color red. It worries them.
When the siren does go off, customers flee the store, leaving behind their full shopping carts.
The workers have to put everything back, but often not before it spoils. Fresh fish, fresh chicken, yellow cheese, pastrami, ground liver, it all goes to waste, and there is nothing you can do with it.
There are 700 businesses in Sderot. 100 of them have closed since Hamas took over Gaza a year and a half ago. Dahan's supermarket has suffered a 50% loss in profits. His accountant says he must fire 10 workers to stay afloat.
I tried to fire an old man who works for me. He's a grandfather. He cried. He pleaded with me not to fire him. So I couldn't do it.
Shmuel Malkiel had no choice. He owns a ballroom. In better days, there were 7 weddings and 10 bar mitzvahs in his hall every month. But recently, he had to fire all 30 of his wait staff. It's not that Sderot residents don't get married or have bar mitzvahs. They just party out of town, because none of their guests would dare to come to their city.
Met.
It's dead, Malkiel says as he switches off the lights in the gold-trimmed hall. It's pretty spooky. All the tables are set and the disco ball hangs in the dark. The ballroom is kind of like the town itself. It's waiting for a reason to celebrate. In Sderot, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from Palestinian business owners in the West Bank. And next week, this program will broadcast live from Dubai. You can find out more about our special, The Middle East at Work, at marketplace.org. Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, Washington Mutual is handing out a whole lot of wah moolah to its executives. That's despite the company's $1.8 billion loss in the fourth quarter. WaMu's board gave thumbs up to an unusual plan that shields head honchos from having their bonuses and other compensation affected by all those foreclosures and unpaid mortgages. Last year, some of the top executives did see their bonuses cut in half, but that silliness is over now. Woohoo! And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 41 points, a third of a percent. The Nasdaq bumped up 12 points, half a percent. And the S&P added 2 points, one-tenth of a percent. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbrononi, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Next time, building around conflict in the West Bank.
Whatever you want to do in Palestine, whatever you want to do, the Israeli closure is part of your decision-making. You cannot get a screw, a nail, a hammer into Palestine if the Israelis don't want you to bring it in.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.